Today's program is brought to you by Bird, Brooklyn's first fashion destination, leading the fashion pack across the river since 1999. For more information, visit shopbird.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. And on the air, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show live every Monday at 1 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. I'm so happy to have Cynthia Hill in the studio with me today. Cynthia is an award-winning director and producer. Her PBS television series, A Chef's Life, which she produces and directs, won a Peabody Award for its first season, which is essentially the sort of Oscar Pulitzer of broadcast journalism. And season two begins in just a few days on October 5th. The show documents the life and work of Chef Vivian Howard and her husband, Ben Knight, who run Chef and the Farmer in Kinston. It's Kinston? Is that right?
Kinston.
Okay. North Carolina. October is actually going to be quite a month for Cynthia. Her new and very powerful documentary, Private Violence, premieres on HBO on October 20th. A feature-length film about domestic abuse, Private Violence explores a simple but deeply disturbing fact of American life. The most dangerous place for a woman in America is in her own home. A master storyteller whose work both celebrates women's achievements and brings attention and light to their struggles. Cynthia, I'm so happy you're here with me today. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We were just talking about whether we're cool enough or hipster enough to be in Bushwick.
Oh, I'm definitely not.
I want to talk a little bit about you before we talk about your work. Where are you from originally?
I'm from a small town in eastern North Carolina called Pink Hill.
And where do you live now?
I live in Durham.
And how far is that from Pink Hill?
That's about a two-hour drive. Okay. And that's about right.
close enough, but far enough. Yeah, that sounds good. And how did you get into filmmaking and production?
Oh, gosh, have mercy. You know, like any filmmaker, I went to pharmacy school. So I have a degree in pharmacy, and I still work as a pharmacist here.
Do you really?
Yeah. It's sort of random sounding, I know, but having that degree has given me the kind of security blanket and the confidence to go out and pursue other things I really want to do, because I know that if all else fails, I can go work in a drugstore.
Wow.
So
you've still got your sort of net underneath you.
Yeah, so the word out there for any filmmaker wannabe is to go to pharmacy school.
Is that something that runs in your family? How'd you get into...
No, my freshman year of school, I was looking at the degrees, and you're supposed to declare your major, and who the heck knows what you want to do when you're 17, 18. So I'm looking at the list, and the highest paying starting salary for any of the degrees was the pharmacy degree. And I was like, that's the one I want. I want to get paid. So, you know, I grew up in a poor family, and you know, I just was tired of being poor. I wanted to do something where I knew that I wouldn't be poor.
So you saw opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. Wow. How interesting.
You weren't expecting that one,
were you? No, you're probably a great person to have during filming too, because if you know about like what anyone needs
sometimes
to take, that kind of thing, that's great. Do you define yourself now, I guess, first a pharmacist, but then is it primarily as a director or as a producer or as both?
I'm definitely both. I think I'm a better director than I am a producer, because like we were talking about earlier, I hate doing research and I hate planning. It's like, you know, for me that's like, oh, the worst. But by default, when you are a documentary filmmaker, you typically have to wear every hat.
Yeah, those roles become pretty intertwined. Yeah,
and so you have to do it. If you know, if it's something that you want to make a film about, you have to figure out how to make that film how to get the money for that film, how to tell the story. You know, all of those parts are your parts.
Absolutely. I was thinking a lot about, in terms of the kind of work you do, I feel like there's a lot of parallels between directing and producing, whether it's a television show or a documentary film, and also running a restaurant. And I was actually thinking about this a lot when I was watching A Chef's Life, because I think you have to be sort of resourceful and driven to make either successful. And I think the two careers really, there's like such, you know, the simultaneous ability to be particular about what you're creating, but also you have to be really adaptable. You know, there's a ton of variables that get in the way of whether it's running a successful restaurant or having a, you know, show that's broadly distributed. So that sort of brings me to A Chef's Life. How did you and Vivian Howard first connect?
We grew up really close to each other. She is from Deep Run, which is, I think, 5 miles from Pink Hill. So our families knew each other. I went to high school with her, one of her older sisters, and she went to school with one of my younger sisters.
Oh, wow.
And so we go way back. So we reconnected when she moved up to New York. I was living in New York at the time, and she spent a couple of nights, because my sister was living with me, and so she spent a couple of nights at the very beginning of her New York journey with me, and that was really the last time I had any contact with her. And I had moved back to North Carolina, and I heard that she had moved back to North Carolina too to open this restaurant, and I thought she was just crazy as a loon. Think, who in the world in their right mind is going to be opening up this high-end farm-to-fork restaurant in Kinston? And where we're from, Kinston is the town, or the city. It's not really a city, but it's, you know, where you would go and you would say, I'm going to town, mm-hmm. and you would go to Kinston.
And how big is Kinston?
Gosh, I should know. I don't know. It's not as big as it used to be. It was a tobacco town, and there was a lot of tobacco money flowing through there. But in the early 90s, it started to disappear. And, you know, with the mass exodus of main streets to the malls that happened there, and also with the tobacco demise, the downtown of Kinston shuttered. I mean, not so much now because of what Vivian's been doing, but I mean, it looked like it was dead.
Mm-hmm.
The town looked dead.
So for anyone who hasn't seen the show, can you sort of sum up why Vivian moved back and decided to open her restaurant there?
Well, she had some success here in New York, cooking, and she had her own soup delivery business, and I think that she was keen on trying to open a storefront, and her parents caught wind of that, and I think that they knew that if she opened up a storefront in New York, they had lost her. So they dangled this opportunity of support and help if she would open this restaurant in Eastern North Carolina.
Yeah.
And in Kinston, and she took them up on it. I still am amazed that it has worked, but it's a beautiful thing what she has done. She came into this town when there was nothing and opened this restaurant, and now this downtown has transformed. It's nothing short of really a miracle, I think.
Wow, pretty amazing. And would you say the people who go to the restaurant are, is it mostly locals? Has it become sort of a destination thing? Like, how does that restaurant fit in?
Yeah, it's a destination restaurant. There are locals that eat there, but there's not enough locals that can eat at that price point,
mm-hmm.
and that restaurant be successful. So she draws from Raleigh, from Greenville, from Wilmington.
And how far is Kinston from these sort of bigger cities?
Like an hour, 15
okay.
minutes. So they're driving. It's a haul.
Sort of how you're describing where you live compared to where you grew up. Sort of close
exactly.
enough, but a little far at the same time.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the content of the show. And I was thinking about last week, we actually had Sarah Moulton on Radio Cherry Bomb, who also has a show on PBS. We were talking about her experience being on television and how it's changed, and how nowadays it seems that networks seem to, in her words, sort of prefer people who are good on TV rather than people who necessarily know about food. And she spoke about how fewer risks are taken and how her mentor, Julia Child, who she worked with for years, probably wouldn't even get a show today by current standards. A Chef's Life isn't your typical food show or cooking show. The first episode starts with Vivian talking so openly and honestly about moving her family back to North Carolina. And I was thinking about how amazing it was to hear a woman business owner talk about, just in those first sort of few minutes, how it doesn't make sense to have more kids when she doesn't even have time to be with the ones she already has. So a show that sort of, you know, there's chef in the title, it's, you know, maybe one would think it's just sort of a food show, but it's so much more than that, and it really is about a life. How would you describe the show?
That's been one of our issues. We don't know how to categorize this show. It has a little bit of reality, which I sometimes cringe at that. I like to call it the real reality. It has documentary elements, mm-hmm. and it has cooking show elements. It's something that when we started out, Vivian and I wanted to document these dying food traditions from Eastern North Carolina, things that we saw our grandmas cook. And I love just being able to highlight our culture there in the eastern part of North Carolina, or Southern culture in general. And so I was really excited to try to do that. But with Vivian, I really just had this feeling that she could be the vehicle to tell that story. You know, she's from there but has been away, and she's coming back, and she has the chef chops. You know, she knows what she's doing. And that was the first thing I learned and was very impressed by her. And she has a general curiosity and desire to learn about these traditions and incorporate those things into her restaurant. And so it just was kind of a perfect little mixture. And when we started, we didn't know how to make a television show. I'd made several documentary films, but I didn't know how to make a television show, and I didn't know how to make a cooking show. So I watched the Food Network for a while and thought, you know, well, I'll learn by watching a few things. But
do you cook? Is that?
No, I don't cook. So I'm like really clueless. But, you know, I found out I didn't really like a lot of the stuff. Mm. You know, there's really nothing that was that compelling to me. And so I thought, well, as I say to Vivian, let's experiment. Let's try something different. And nobody was telling us what to do because nobody cared. So it was
a great
luxury.
Place to start something.
Yeah,
for sure.
It was a luxury. Yeah. And it was horrible on one hand because nobody cared, but it was a luxury because nobody cared enough to tell us what to do. So we were able to figure this thing out on our own, and we were able to create something that no one had created before.
So, because I was going to ask you sort of the logistics, kind of the chicken and egg question, which mm-hmm. came first, the show or your relationship with PBS? It sounds like you were making material before PBS got wind of it. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
I was actually thinking about that. Another parallel was sort of between restaurants and production. And I guess it's true to any industry, but one of the most important things is financing. And I know firsthand that part of the difficulty, and I think also the appeal of having a show on PBS, is having to do all the fundraising. So it's true, if you have a show on PBS, you have to bring in all the sponsors.
Yes. Oh, yes.
But in exchange, you get creative control. You get to make the show you want to make.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about, you know, this is so similar to sort of new restaurateurs getting investors. And I feel like I'm just curious how you sell it, because it's like as if someone is trying to open a restaurant, get an investor. Like, how do you get someone excited to support your restaurant when you don't have a restaurant yet for them to come and try? So
yeah.
what do you bring to PBS?
You're
or
like,
any network?
You're like, trust me. I know what I'm doing, but I don't. It's hard. You know, you have something in your head that you think is going to be really great. Will it be? I don't know. You just have to try. And so that's basically what we had to do, is we had to make the first episode mm-hmm. before anybody was going to pay any attention to us whatsoever. So we made episode one, and conveniently for me, not so convenient for Vivian, her kitchen burns down in the first episode.
Which is great for television.
Yeah, horrible for her, but I'm sitting there going, oh my gosh, we got to go film. So it's that, I think, sort of jolted me back to my documentary roots. And I thought, well, the heck with making a cooking show, we're making a documentary series, because I think it's so interesting watching this family and learning about what all they've put into making this restaurant and then seeing it all disappear. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do when that happens? And I thought we were really in a unique position to be able to share that with the world. And Vivian at the time, we joke about this, you know, she's just so honest and so, she lets me in there. She lets us in there, and we show things that people don't see on TV, and we see her real emotions. We see her and her husband bicker, and we see her argue with her parents, and these are things that, you know, she trusts me and the show and this relationship and what we're trying to do so much. And I think it's just incredible that we're able to share that mm-hmm. with an audience.
I agree. And I think, I mean, I know from watching it, and it seems like from the numbers of people who have watched it, there's a consensus that people do, you know, want to see this, and it's amazing material. And I think just in the way that you and Vivian have a relationship that allows this material to exist for a bigger audience, yeah. the relationship of the audience to the show mm-hmm. is growing. And
yeah, we're best friends now. You know, and yeah. and I know what's happening in her life, and we map out an episode, and we go and we start shooting, and then half the time the episode changes midstream because we are filming and something happens that seems like that's a better way mm-hmm. to end the episode. And so we have the luxury, because of the close proximity that I have with her, and also just our ability to listen and pay attention. You know, we're not there shooting a whole season's worth in 3 weeks. We pop in when there's something to film, and when there's not anything to film, we pop out.
That's sort of amazing. I think being willing to follow a new ending yeah. rather than the one you planned is such an incredible just sort of metaphor for all sorts of yeah. creative
or
pursuits.
Make two episodes yeah. instead of one. I did that twice in season two. We were filming such incredible content, and I look over to Vivian, I'm like, this is way too much good stuff for one episode. Mm. Let's make this one a two-parter. She's like, okay.
That's so funny. I was thinking about, because you won a Peabody Award for this first season.
Which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, I love the tagline of the Peabody Awards, which is awarding stories that matter. How has receiving the award affected the show? Has it helped you secure more sponsorship for these new seasons, or...?
No.
No.
It does make people pay more attention, though. You know, it's a nice stamp of approval. Yeah. Who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want their work recognized in that way? You know, I'm no different. Vivian's no different in that way.
No, it's incredible sort of credibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, okay, what we are doing does matter.
And people are watching.
People are watching it.
Responding.
And yes, and they get it, and we're not crazy.
Cool.
Well, maybe a little bit, but not completely crazy.
October 5th is the next season.
October yeah. 5th, it starts.
Very exciting. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk more about your new documentary.
Today's program brought to you by Bird Brooklyn. Bird is Brooklyn's first fashion destination, leading the fashion pack across the river since 1999. Bird has been voted best women's boutique in New York City by New York Magazine, top visionary boutique in the United States by Lucky Magazine, and has received extensive coverage in the New York Times. After first opening in Park Slope in 1999, a second location in Cobble Hill was opened in 2006. The third and largest location, designed by Norwegian architect Ole Sandresen, opened in Williamsburg in 2009 and is the first LEED certified retail store in New York City. Bird offers a wide range of contemporary and luxury collections for men and women, in addition to supporting and showcasing emerging local designers and artists. For more, visit shopbird.com.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian, and I'm back with the great Cynthia Hill. We're going to switch gears from A Chef's Life, your PBS series that you make with Vivian Howard, and we're going to talk about Private Violence, your feature-length film that's going to be premiering on October 20th on HBO. I think you were saying when we walked into the studio today, it's sort of when it rains, it pours, and you've got a lot of things happening this coming month.
I shouldn't complain.
Tell us a little bit about the mission of the film.
When I started working on this project, I was brought on board to help tell the history of the domestic violence movement or advocacy movement. And I was working with this incredible advocate, Kit Gorell, and I just became fascinated with her and her work and what I was seeing happening now. So, long story short, we ended up not doing the history part and made a film about Kit and a few of the other women that she came into contact with, including Deanna Walters, who her story becomes the main story arc in the film. She was kidnapped, her along with her 3-year-old daughter, by her estranged husband and taken on a cross-country trucking trip and severely beaten. Wow. The whole way. And she was, the truck was finally stopped on their way back. And this is from North Carolina to California. The truck was stopped back in Oklahoma and he was not arrested. And, you know, she looks like, in the photos that the nurse at the emergency room took of her, she looks like a corpse. She looks that badly beaten. And I was just like, this is not right. And when she gets back to North Carolina, the local prosecutor there in the county just felt like, you know, it was, would be, his chances would not be good at all at getting any sort of prosecution. And so they basically were going to let it go. And the feds end up picking up the case. And we follow this story all the way through. And so we're able to see Deanna finally receive justice. Wow. And her ex-husband go to prison.
And at what point did you start following her story, sort of for the film?
When we met her, Kit was holding or conducting a training session and with women who wanted to become advocates. And we met Deanna in this session. She was about 3 months out of, I think, from the incident. And she tells her story to this group of women for the very first time. And I heard it and I thought, okay, this one's worth sticking with.
And how do you, sort of earlier when you were talking, I mean, it's a completely different subject matter, but in terms of your role, and you were talking about the process with Vivian about how honest she is on A Chef's mm-hmm. Life, and I mean, I know from watching the show how amazing it is to see someone sort of talk to the camera, to talk to her director that openly, and how that translates. In something like Private Violence, what is the process of getting your subjects sort of feel comfortable enough and safe enough to be able to do that?
With this film, because Kit is there, it's this whole other dynamic because there's an advocate in the room. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to play that role. I can kind of sit back and film the scene and allow Kit to do her work. And not everybody's going to be open like Kit or Deanna. And so that's just part of, you know, I hate to say this, but it's part of casting. You know, with documentary films, you do cast. You know, you have to work with people who are willing to work with you. And so that's what it's about. You got to find people who want to tell their story.
Absolutely. And you're also talking about such a huge and important issue, and it's a, you know, it's a wide umbrella, and there's so many stories underneath it that are important to tell, and then narrowing in on certain ones. I think telling the advocacy story.
Yeah, that's something that I hadn't seen before. I had seen victim stories before, but I'd never seen the advocacy side of it. And really, for me, it was about that question. And now in the media, I think it's we're finally starting to have a conversation that's meaningful about it. But we would always ask, why doesn't she just leave? I was asking that, and I should know better. But I was asking that sort of question when that ultimately puts the blame back on the victim. It's her responsibility instead of looking in the other direction and asking, why is he beating her or why is he treating her that way? Why is it that as a society we let him get away with that? And so I felt as though that we had a lot of room to make this film and to really move that needle. We really could make a difference with this film.
Amazing. And do you, in terms of sort of your role on it, how would you say, what were the differences between spending time making this film and then the time you spend making a TV show? How does that, how does it translate to the story? How does it change?
It's so different. I worked on this film for 6 years.
Wow.
So, I think documentary films, they tend to take a long time. One, because it's a beast to try to fundraise for it. And then two, for me, I like trying to follow stories as they unfold. And so sometimes that takes a while.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing about being an independent filmmaker is you have that luxury, though. You can, if you are passionate about the subject matter, you can take as long as you need to tell that story.
So you, I mean, do you have any sort of typical day in the life where every day is sort of you're following multiple stories at once? And
no, I wish I could spend more time actually doing the filmmaking part. That's the thing that's, I think most filmmakers will tell you that, you know, they spend very little time actually making films. They spend a lot of time trying to fundraise for films, trying to distribute films. You know, and that's, I mean, that's just a part of the gig. You get used to it. It's all about wearing all those hats.
Yeah. And how do you feel? I mean, you are about to have a television project and its second season on PBS, a film project on HBO. It's sort of, you know, I keep going back to this parallel with restaurants. It's almost like having two completely different restaurants in different cities. Do you feel any similarity between those two projects, or is there any parallel?
For me, it's about telling stories that are important to women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the cooking show or the reality show or the documentary series, whatever you want to call it, with Vivian, I think it's just incredible to be able to share this woman who is tackling all of this, share her story and show how she is successful, but also show when she has bad days. You know, she's a real woman. The same thing with this domestic violence film. You know, I think the prevailing notion is that domestic violent victims are weak, but I have found quite the opposite. You know, these are very strong women. You know, they've been beaten down literally and figuratively. And so they are getting back up every single day and surviving. It takes a lot. And I think for me, it's just important to be able to show women. You know, I think that we don't have enough films and enough TV shows that highlight the work of women.
Absolutely. And amazing that it's also being made and supported by so many women. And I know Gloria Steinem helped to produce this documentary. Who else is behind this film?
Well, of course, HBO. They came on board towards the end of the process, but it's been really amazing working with them and having their resources, and that's something that's new for me. And I think that that's really going to help us with getting that message out there with the film so that we can make a difference. We've got an incredible group of executive producers on board, Chicken and Egg Pictures, Artemis Rising, Candescent Film, and the Wade Institute. So it's one of those projects that you cannot do it by yourself.
Sure.
You've got to have people who are willing to go on this journey with you.
Absolutely. And such an important journey. Where's Kit now?
Well, she's in New York right now.
Yeah.
We have a screening at HBO tonight, and it's Gloria Steinem's going to be there, so I'm kind of excited about that. But Kit and Deanna are both here, and Stacey Cox, who was Deanna or is Deanna's advocate, she's also here. And it's just, for me, that's what makes it worth it to me, seeing Deanna grow, and she's in school now, and she and I went out to dinner last night, and she was telling me she's going to be graduating next December, and just to think of where she has been, and then looking ahead and seeing what the potential is for her now, that's pretty incredible.
That's amazing. Have they seen the film yet, or will tonight be their first?
They've seen the film.
Okay.
We premiered the film at Sundance this year, which is another pretty amazing opportunity to do. And they saw it there for the first time. And talk about nerve-wracking. When you are sharing somebody's story, something that's this personal and intimate, and you know, it's scary as a filmmaker knowing that you're doing that and they've trusted you, and then you're just hoping that they like it and that they're not angry with you at the end of it. So it's been a pretty amazing and incredible journey working on this film. We've got a lot of work ahead of us, but I do feel as though that having it out there and it can be a part of this conversation that we're already having that it really can do some good.
How incredible. I mean, it really sounds like in a film that's telling the story about the importance of advocacy. I mean, you're acting as the director of this film as such an important advocate as well. And I mean, you are trusted with such a personal and important story, and you're representing someone, and I can't wait to see it. It sounds incredible. What's next for you? What are you currently working on?
I hope vacation.
You're going to take a nap.
We are shooting season 3 of A Chef's Life. If we waited until the end of season 2, we would be shooting a lot of root vegetables. So we decided to go ahead and get started in July. So we are in the process of shooting episode 6. So in between all the traveling I'm doing with Private Violence, I'm headed back to Kinston on the weekends that I'm back in North Carolina, and we're filming. But I love that. It is going home for me, because that's where I grew up, and I'm telling the stories of my grandma. You know, she's not with me anymore, but it does feel like I'm with her when I get to share those stories of her people and my people.
That's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. That sounds like sort of the same experience for Vivian as well, being able to share all those stories. I just think all of us who get to watch your material are really just the lucky ones, and it's amazing to listen to these stories and see them. I can't believe I'm about to say this, because I feel like I could talk to you all day about everything that you're working on and that you've done, but we're nearly out of time, and I always feel like a therapist when I say that, like, our session's coming to a close
just
today.
More minutes,
but I want to leave time for, in much, much lighter news, our Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A, which are 7 questions I ask every guest who comes on. So totally no pressure whatsoever. But a fun kind of light note to end on.
Can you pass on some of them?
Totally. Whatever is a comfortable answer is fine by me. Okay. Number 1, sweet or salty?
Salty.
2, what did you have for breakfast today?
Oh, that pizza that we just had.
Which is the, which one? It was the Cowabunga pizza,
the Cowabunga.
I think? Yeah. It's got like onions, olives.
Mm-hmm. You got to have something to absorb that bourbon.
If I were to look into your refrigerator at home right now, what might I be surprised to find?
You'd probably be surprised by what you don't find. There's nothing in there. There's milk and white milk and chocolate milk. I have 2 little ones at home, and that's about what's in there.
What's your go-to snack?
Oh, I love fruit, grapes. I can eat a bag of grapes a day.
Actually, I'm going to add another special Cynthia question to the rapid fire, because I love how a chef's life is organized by ingredient. Mm-hmm. What's been your sort of, has there been any ingredient you've discovered from making the show?
Oh gosh, nothing that I've necessarily discovered. There's things that I like that I didn't think I liked. just Vivian cooking anything is good, though. I mean, it's like the best gig in the world.
Good
there,
answer.
You got, you know, you're watching her cook, and then you get to eat it.
Yeah,
I mean, who doesn't love
Pretty
that?
Pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite time of day?
Bedtime.
And where do you want to travel to next?
Home.
I bet. And lastly, what was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Oh, I loved my grandma's tomatoes and macaroni. Mm. So she would put in her jarred tomatoes, canned tomatoes, and cook up some macaroni with those. And that's like, that is home.
That sounds really good. Mm-hmm. Cynthia, thank you so much for being here today. Your work is just so important and meaningful, and it's been a real honor to have you on Radio Cherry Bomb. Before we sign off, I want to give some online resources. So your personal Twitter handle is at DocuSouth, is that right?
Yes.
D-O-C-U South.
I think so. I'll probably walk out of here and go, no, that's not my handle.
Information about A Chef's Life can be found at achefsliferies.com, and the show's Twitter handle is at ChefSouth. The second season, again, starts on PBS on October 5th. And if you go
check
to
your local listings.
Yeah, exactly. Find out where it's playing near you. And how can listeners watch the first season if they haven't already seen it?
Right now it is on PBS.org.
Awesome.
So it's not going to be up for that much longer. I'm not exactly sure.
So watch it now. Absolutely.
Before it's too late.
Information about Private Violence can be found at privateviolence.com and on Twitter at Private Violence. And it premieres October 20th on HBO, I believe at 9:00.
Yes.
So set your DVR, your TiVo, whatever you use.
Please watch it.
And as always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Monday at 1:00 for another new episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.